All right, so though we're firmly into the reign of Solomon, we're still going to talk about David for a minute. So we're in 1 Kings 4 and 5, and so I've asked the question as we deal with, and again, what I've been talking about, you're going to bounce back and forth between Kings and Chronicles. So in 1 Chronicles 23 through 29, we see what I'm talking about, this administration of the kingdom and what's going on. The question is, the kingdom of Israel was vastly different in the time of Solomon than in the time of David. Who transformed the nation and its administration? And did anybody understand that question? I agree with you. And so I feel like the key to that, and I gave you a lot of chapters to look at, but 23:1 says, then David reached an old age, and he made his son Solomon king over Israel. That's 1 Chronicles 23:1. And he gathered together all the leaders of Israel with the priests and the Levites, and then he started numbering people, and then you'll see that things start changing a little bit. Now, this is open to some... This is subjective, I guess, in a way. But how did you view, or how do you view David's kingdom versus Solomon's kingdom? How would you compare and contrast them?
One was a war, God of battle, and Solomon's was peaceful.
Solomon's was peaceful. So you got war versus peace. How else would you, in your mind, not necessarily, because my mind has changed as I've studied this, but when you think of David's kingdom versus Solomon's kingdom, what else do you think of? Okay, so the administration of the kingdom and how things were done, especially with the Levites, which is what these chapters are about, that changed completely. Anything else? Y'all haven't read my mind yet. When I think of David's kingdom, I think a lot of, and I'm going to make an association, and I don't know if y'all know who these people are, but Steve Jobs and Tim Cook. Steve Jobs being the person who created the iPod and then the iPhone, and then Tim Cook, who is now the CEO of Apple. How I relate to that, to David and Solomon, is David to me is more of the hardware guy. He's the one, that's what Steve Jobs did. He was a creator. He invented things. David was the one who put together the kingdom. He was the one who grew the kingdom. You think about that in that sense, as far as he's alike in that way. Now, Tim Cook has taken over Apple, and he's grown the business. He's made alliances, he's made partnerships, he's managed it, and he's grown the business in that way. So David assembled the kingdom in a lot of ways. He routed out a lot of people, he assembled this mighty nation, and then now Solomon is the one left to manage it. And you see that in the marriage alliance with Pharaoh's daughter. You see it as you go through and how he has economic control over a vast amount of area. One of the things I think about with David, we think a lot about his warring, and I don't necessarily connote a lot of David's reign with riches and plenty as much as you read about Solomon. Now, that's where my mind has been changed, because there was plenty, but you don't read as much about that then, and the wealth and the prosperity. You read about the warring and the accomplishments of David and how he's a mighty man, a man of God, whereas in Solomon, we read more about some of the economic status as they face times of peace. We read about how great the nation is, but in David's time, you know, especially as he got older, he'd amassed all this bounty. He'd got all this treasure for building the temple. He built a house like Solomon's going to build with Hiram, who was the one who helped build the temple and who helped build Solomon's house. And so I don't necessarily think of, when I think of David, I don't think of, well, David had riches and prestige and bounty, but he did. I mean, the nation of Israel was continuing to grow. I just automatically go from David to Solomon, and the nation seems like it's changed overnight. That's not the case, and for me, this is a good way you can see a transition. This transition specifically is discussing, you know, now that we're going to build the temple, you know, how things are going to change. So I asked him the next question: what happens in 1 Chronicles 23, 24 through 32, and why? No longer caring for the tabernacle. Yes, the Levites aren't doing that anymore. What are they doing?
Busy
Okay. So why is that changing? So the temple is going to be built. So you had the Levites who were to take care of the tabernacle, but if we're establishing a house of God, and that's what verse 25, so 1 Chronicles 23:25, for David said, the Lord God of Israel has given rest to his people, and he dwells in Jerusalem forever. So there's no need to travel the tabernacle around anymore. They've been established, they have peace on all sides. And so 26, also the Levites will no longer need to carry the tabernacle and all its utensils for its service. For by the last words of David, the son of Levi, were numbered from 20 years and upward. And then we get into kind of what's going to happen next. And so we see this, I'm not big on subtitles for your Bible, but mine, you know, it's duties revised for the Levites, for revision of duties. The Levites' roles and responsibilities are going to change some based on the temple being built versus having a tabernacle. So through this, if you read some of it, you know, it's a bunch of names and stuff like that. So you kind of move forward a little bit and you get into 1 Chronicles 26. And I put, who's in charge of the treasure in 1 Chronicles 26? The Levites. The Levites are in charge of this treasure. Now, we've discussed the quantity of treasure that there is. We talked about the 100,000 talents of gold. If a talent 75 pounds, we talked about how many billions of dollars that would equate to today and what it would equate to as far as work then for those people, million talents of silver. They're in charge of keeping up with all this. It was for repair of the tabernacle. It was for building the temple as it goes on. That's a huge responsibility for them. Who dedicated the treasure and from what and where? The spoils from the battle. So that would be that was kind of the where part of it, you know, the what and where of it all. The spoils from battle. So you see that in 1 Chronicles 26:27. So they dedicated part of the spoils won in battle to repair the house of the Lord. Okay, but what about the who? Because this was interesting to me as well. The heads of the households gave. That was verse 26, they dedicated the relatives had charge of the treasures of the dedicated gifts, which King David, being one of the who's, and the heads of the father's households, the commanders of the thousands and the hundreds, and the commanders of the army had dedicated. But who else? That was in the care of, but I'm looking more into what in verse 28. Yeah, and all that Samuel the seer had dedicated, and Saul the son of Kish, and Abner the son of Ner, and Joab the son of Zerah, everyone had dedicated anything and all of what was in the care of this person. So you think about who dedicated to building the temple. Unless I'm wrong, it seems that Samuel dedicated things. Did he know for sure that it was dedicated for that, or maybe it was for the tabernacle? Same thing with Saul. You think about Abner who was killed. You think about Joab who was executed. These people, Saul, you know, being a bad king, but they still dedicated. Just found it interesting that their spoils and, you know, their treasure was dedicated to the temple as well. Questions, comments, thoughts on that? All right. Yeah, I just found that interesting, seeing as Samuel reaches all the way back into 1 Samuel, you know, 2, 3, and 4. Did he know about the temple then, or did he know about it when he was older? Did he start dedicating things maybe for the tabernacle when it was used for the temple? It's just interesting that mix of people, and that it's noteworthy. You know, it's recorded for us that those people had dedicated stuff to the temple. How was moving forward? So, you know, we're talking about the change of the administration in certain things. Okay, so, you know, David has been a nomad in a lot of ways, and then he finally built his home in Jerusalem. He's established his house there. And he had his own army, but, you know, think about Jerusalem think about Israel as a nation as they were conquering the land of Canaan. You know, they were constantly, seemed like, on the move, trying to get things taken care of. And now you have this establishment, and now you're going to have, a change in army and in command. So my question was, how was the army of the nation of Israel staffed, and by who? That would be in chapter 27. They would take, yes, ma'am. So each of the 12 tribes, so you 27-1. Now, this is the enumeration of the sons of Israel, the heads of fathers' households, the commanders of thousands and hundreds, and their officers who served the king and all the affairs of the divisions which came in and out and went out month by month throughout all the months of the year, each division numbering 24,000. So each month you had a different household or a different tribe who provided it basically a standing army. Now, at any given time, we see that you could call the army up, but that's who was there for protection at that time. They were the standing army, and they divided that equally. Why? I'm not necessarily I don't understand why. I'm thinking maybe everybody gets an opportunity to help defend the country. It's a pride and prestige thing. Maybe if nothing else, we want to protect and serve our country and serve our king. Maybe that's something. But then you still could go home to your house. Maybe somebody can explain that a little bit better as to the why of it all. But it was interesting to me also that 24,000 men, each tribe every month. So as we're talking about the kind of this change, you know, this is how the nation is changing. You know, Levitical priests are getting they're getting different duties and responsibilities. You see the nation's established. Everything's kind of centered around Jerusalem now. We continue to talk about the temple. The next class we'll actually talk about building the temple. But this is how the nation has changed. Now, we'll get into it in just a second, but we'll talk about economically. How did it change as well? How was Solomon's house provided for? So now we're back in 1 Kings 4. How was Solomon's house provided for? What version are you reading out of? I'm just curious. Mine says deputies. I think it connotes the same thing. But yeah, Solomon had 12 deputies, 12 governors, who provided for the king and his household.
What did yours say?
Deputies.
What?
Deputies.
We would
probably
call them tax collectors.
Tax collectors. Well, that's a better. I mean, that's interesting too. I didn't get to look into the name of it. So have you looked into that as far as like their tax they collect from their areas?
Okay. Their term, they would give vision.
Okay. So you can look back to the old law, and you can look back to Samuel and 1 Samuel 10 when they were talking.
All right.
Well, that's. Well, maybe if we have time within the class, maybe we'll go back and look at that. So, see, you learn stuff every day. I was thinking about it from the standpoint, too, that, you know, we're going to look at in a second, you know, how vast of a nation this is and what Solomon has amassed. And this nation is very blessed, got a bounty of things. And so I found that interesting that that's how his house was provided for. It makes more sense that it would be tax collectors, but you see what they're gonna be taking care of here in a second. So in 1 Kings 4, 20, it says, how are Israel and Judah described in verse 20? So numerous as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. They were eating and drinking and rejoicing. They were a lot of people, and they were having a good old time. And that's nothing bad. I mean, they have rest on all sides. And so you see the nation is growing over and over again. So using 1 Kings 4, 21 through 25, describe the scope of Solomon's rule in the land and its political status. And I didn't, you know, I mean, we'll read the verses, but just kind of give an idea. Okay, so the Euphrates River, which is up top, you've got all the way down to Egypt, which is down south, the Mediterranean Sea. Let's see, and your orientation's over here on the west, my orientation's over here. And then it expanded out. You said past the Sea of Galilee, Rocky? Is that what you said? So his area, and that's one of the things I'm going to try and attempt in a second. We'll look at the map to see what that's done for him. But it says in verse 21, now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river of the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So he's got this area. What about his political status? He's very wise. He's I don't know if you'd say exalted, but he's revered in other nations. What about the nation itself, too? Ma'am? They lived in safety. He kept his kingdom. He kept his kingdom secure. They were a world power. They were looked after. People brought alms to them. They were a dominant force in that period of time. Now let's see if we can get this to work. So I'm a visual learner, so maybe this will help a little bit. Okay, good, okay. You don't see that, right? Here, I'll turn this down a little bit, though. All right. So, this will kind of give you an idea of the area in which, I don't have to look at that, y'all can look at that. The area in which Solomon ruled. So, you'll see first, you'll see here, you've got the yellow and purple area. That was what Saul ruled over. All right, that was the Judah and Israel. It's purple for David when he ruled, when the kingdom split for a time, when David ruled over Judah and Ishbosheth ruled over Israel. So, but the reign and rule of Saul covers that purple and yellow area. Then, whoops. Was a back button somewhere. All right, so then the green area, so you kind of have this here and around. This is the consolidated nation of Israel as David established it. So we read all the times that David was warring. That's what he did there. He went through and he established the kingdom. He spread it out. He ran other people out. You'll notice and see here the Philistines. Philistia? Is that how you say that? Philistia? So they've got they're kind of relegated to their own little side there. But David vastly expanded the kingdom and that territory as he did what God had wanted him to do. Then you see the red areas. So you see the red areas outlined all the way around. That is what Solomon had at least economic control over. So he ruled over the same nation that David did, but we see the dotted lines here at the top. That is what he had economic control over. So that is the area in which he ruled economically. Now, what does that mean to us? What am I trying to get at? Let's see. All right, so if we're looking at the Middle East now, all right, so you're talking about the nation of Israel was somewhere in here, right? Right down through here, kind of like this. Now, they had completely blocked off, and we'll look at this a little closer in a second, but yet trade routes through Egypt, through Arabia, coming from India, Edom was down here. All those trade routes had to go through the nation of Israel. And so in doing that, the nation continued to grow and prosper. So having economic control over the region, why? Well, because the easiest way then, they didn't have cars, buses, forklifts. They had ships, but ships weren't like it was today. And ship was the easiest way to travel, depending on the time of year, or the easiest way to transport cargo. And so they had control of a vast part of the sea there, where you had to go through their territory to be able to ship or to move your goods. So you think about that. So on this map, so right here is the borderline of the bottom of the nation of Israel. That's actually a river. I can't remember which one it is, but that officially blocks off Egypt. So if you're going to come from Egypt, from Africa into the Middle East, you've got to go through Israel. Then it kind of comes around here, comes up here, and right here where I'm at right there is the Euphrates River, and then it kind of comes around, and then it carves out, I think it's Phoenicia, and then a little bit of the Philistia. And so how do you get to the water? I'm not sure what all world powers were there in this time, but you know Egypt was a world power at one point and still very prosperous. I'm not sure what all was in Europe. You know there was stuff going on in India, but anything you wanted to ship to the Mediterranean, you had to come through Israel. Now, Israel was also very prosperous. They were a huge nation. They were so, you know, it was, this led to some of that. Now, to make this all happen, you know, Solomon is a very wise man, and you see at least in one instance, and I'll talk about a little bit later, where, you know, he had a lot of wives, but he made alliances. He did this. You know, this is how the nation grew. And so they had a control over that entire area. And so Israel was an economic power as much as it was a world power in the sense of force and might. Questions, comments on that? Okay. I'm a visual person, so that helped me to understand a little bit more about how that area was ruled. All right, I think we're done with this for now. I'm gonna turn the lights back up. All right, so the scope of Solomon's rule, you know, they were a mighty force in the sense of world power. Why was that?
Location.
I mean, but they were revered, they were feared. Why would they be that way?
Solomon's wisdom.
Where did he get his wisdom from?
God.
And so I don't want to lose sight of that. You know, Solomon is attributed to being a great king. It's attributed to him wisdom and power and money, but it's all from God. And once things turn south and God's forgotten, we see that the nation starts to fall apart when he's not followed. God allowed this to happen. You think about it from the standpoint of then and then now too. Things are accelerated in a sense, but they were, Moses was around 1500 BC, I think, and by the time David was reigning, it was about 1000 BC. So in 500 years, you have the Israelites going from slaves in the land of Egypt to a world power. They've conquered this land, and there was a purpose behind it. We go back to Deuteronomy 4, where we see that it was, you know, the purpose is to glorify God so that others may know. They were to follow the statutes, ordinances, commands of God, because that's what was best for them, but it was also so that others could see their God and his wisdom and the wisdom of the nation. And so this didn't just happen by chance. In 500 years from slaves to world power, that's by the providence of God. That nation economically didn't grow or wasn't situated in a perfect spot just by happenstance. That was because of God. And so all this is facilitated by God. It's what he has promised, that he'll establish the kingdom forever. You think about the covenant that was made to David in 2 Samuel 7. Had things continued to go, who knows how long the nation of Israel would have lasted. But, you know, that's the lot in life of the people who just choose not to be obedient to God's will. So when we talk about the economic status, here's some indicators. So I put on here, how many chariots, horsemen, and stalls did Solomon have? 40,000 stalls, and we'll get back to that one in a second. What else? How many chariots did he have? 12,000 chariots or 12,000 horsemen?
Oh, 40,000
stalls, horses, chariots. There's so many horses, chariots. So he had 12,000 horsemen. It says 1,400 chariots. That's, I threw you all for a loop. I didn't give you all the, I think on y'all's copy too, y'all don't have verses for any of this, right? Oh, y'all did have some? And the 1,400 chariots comes from 2 Chronicles 1:14. That's my fault. You've got 12,000 horsemen. You see in 2 Chronicles 9:25, hold up. Is it a footnote here? It's a footnote in our verse, 1 Kings 4:26, that number of 40,000 stalls might read also 4,000. And you also see that in 2 Chronicles 9. And 4,000 stalls is still a lot of stalls when you consider, you know, what it, we were going to look at in just a second, what it costs to acquire these animals, and then what you'd think it would cost to feed them. But he had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 men in those chariots, and then he had 4,000 stalls for horses. I mean, that's a lot for that nation. It shows monetary value and gain. Just, you wonder why it's put in there, but maybe it's just to help you understand the affluence or of the nation itself.
Hey,
yes, ma'am.
You think that 14,000?
The 1,400 is in 1,400 chariots. That's 2 Chronicles 1:14. I threw you off for a loop. I wasn't very good with my verses on this lesson. So who provided the horses? Who provided for the horses?
Each of the deputies.
So not only were they were governors, tax collectors. We got all kinds of names for it. So not only did these not only did these men take care of the household, this may have been considered a part of the household, or it may have just been extra, that they provided also barley and straw for the horses, the swift steeds, to the place where it should be according to his charge. So they took care of all these horses as well. Using verses 29 through 34, describe Solomon's wisdom as it's understood here in these verses. Excellent and observant, okay. Ma'am?
Alluring.
Excellent and alluring, okay. That's a good word, alluring.
It's known by all the kings of the world and the nations, you know. Every one of them knew it was greater than any man down here.
Yes, more wise than any man. And it was known, verse 30 says, Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. And then there's a bunch of guys named here who I guess were supposed to be pretty wise. It says his fame is known in all the surrounding nations. We know a little bit about this because of why? Not reading my mind again.
3,000 Proverbs.
We've got Proverbs is 30 chapters. We've got that. We've got Song of Solomon. We've got. Stuff that we hear in this in Chronicles and Kings that tell us about his wisdom, especially Proverbs, you can go through and look, and it's, you know, extremely helpful principles that are laid out or things that you should live by. Really, really wise man. He also, it says his songs were 1,005, and I didn't know that Solomon wrote songs. Jack of all trades, I guess. You think about that. So he was known throughout the land. So smartest man of all, and it's, you know, to what end? I guess would be a question I'd ask you. To what end is this wisdom? To what end would being known throughout the land help?
Glorify the God you
serve, and that he served. I think that's the way Linda phrased it. That's right. That it's understood. You look at Solomon and how wise he was. And you look at and have an understanding that in the way that he acted, the way that he judged, that, you know, there is a God. And we'll see this moving into later chapters. I think it's 1 Kings 9. How wise our God is, how great our God is because of what he's done for Solomon. His wisdom and his administration, his rule over this kingdom is all to glorify God. That's the purpose here. So that all nations can know God through them. Questions, comments, considerations? No, yes? All right, so we get into the temple again. So in 1 Kings 5, who is Hiram and why have we heard of him before?
He loved David.
So he was a friend of David. Why else have we heard? Ma'am?
He built David's house.
And so we can go back and look after David established the capital city of Jerusalem, or made Jerusalem the capital city, and he built a house. We see Hiram helped him build his house. Hiram is
king of Tyre.
He's also a very skilled, what do you call him, artist or sculptor or what? He's very skilled with his hands, I guess, and what he can do. And we see here that Solomon is going to barter with him. What is Solomon getting from King Hiram?
Cedar and cypress logs.
Cedar and cypress logs.
Gold, silver,
bronze,
or men to work it.
Men to work it. Okay, so that's over. Look over at 2 Chronicles 2. This is that bouncing back and forth, and we're comparing the timelines in both Chronicles and Kings. You get extra information. In 2 Chronicles 2, 5, it says, "The house which I'm about to build will be great, for greater is our God than all the gods. But who is able to build a house for him? For the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain him. So who am I and that I should build a house for him except to burn incense before him? Now send me a skilled man to work in gold, silver, brass and iron, and in purple, crimson, and violet fabrics, and who knows how to make engravings to work with the skilled men who I have in Judah and Jerusalem, whom David my father provided." So he's not only getting trees, but he's getting skilled labor to come and help with building the temple. What did Solomon give King Hiram in return? Wheat and oil. All right, what else?
Barley and wine.
Let's see here. It's verse 10 of. Got this here somewhere. Verse 10 of 1 Kings, you said?
2
Chronicles. Third. I have that in my notes. There it is. Hey. Now behold, I will give to your servants the woodsmen who cut the timber, 20,000 cores of crushed wheat, 20,000 cores of barley, 20,000 baths of wine, 20,000 baths of oil. So that's not everything that's listed in Kings, but we see it's listed here in Chronicles. So he's making this trade for the skilled labor and for materials to help build the temple. How were the trees to be cut in Tyre, and what was the arrangement for those who went? Heard something. Okay, work 1 month off two. Who's doing that? The Israelites, you're right. It calls them something.
Forced labor.
Forced labor. It says forced labor. Let's get back to Kings. So if you look at 1 Kings 5:13, it says, "Now King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel, and the forced laborers numbered 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon." I said Tyre, so they sent them to Lebanon, Tyre being a city. So it doesn't necessarily specify Tyre. I've used that as a point of reference for something in a second. But he sends them to Lebanon, to the forest of Lebanon, to get these trees. And he sent 10,000 a month in relays. They were in Lebanon a month, and 2 months they were at home. So he had forced laborers, 30,000 men to go cut trees. Yes, ma'am. You know, I'll be honest, I didn't check different translations to see if it translated different ways. What are you reading from? New King James? I'm reading from New American Standard. So does anybody else have ESV or something along those lines?
ESV says
drafted forced labor. I don't think this would be. I think Lauren's got it. You said it was labor force. I don't know that it was enslaving them. Maybe drafted would be a better word. I'd have to go back and look for sure, but I know that they weren't to be enslaved. So
in 1 Kings 5:13, it says, "Now King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel." They were drafted.
Okay, they were raised up. I don't want to connote that they were slaves by any means, but it may have been drafted. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, and it was against the law, too, for them to be enslaved in that way. So, maybe it was just you're drafted into the service. And I don't know that this draft in that sense would have been a bad thing. You know, you're going to work to help, you know, provide materials for the temple. I need...
CCP?
Sir?
The CCP?
Yes, ma'am.
I thought Hiram's people were doing the cutting, and they would put it on the sea, and
So,
Hiram, you said, me, my servants will bring them down. First Kings 5, I thought it was talking about, I'll do what would you desire concerning the cedar. My servants will bring them down from Lebanon to the sea, and I will make them into grass. And over in 2 Chronicles 2, we will cut whatever timber you need from Lebanon.
Well, first Kings 5, 6 says, now therefore command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants. So Hiram had men doing it too. But David sent 30,000 men to do that, and then he had 70,000 set aside for transport, which we'll get to in a second, for transport of the trees and of the stone. So Hiram had men cutting, but in this here, he levied men to send them over. And these 30,000 men, if I understood it, were to cut the trees as well, because you have a different labor force that's going to carry the trees back. That's what we see in verse 15. They were called the transporters. Yeah, so you're hiring Hiram's force, and then he's providing men as well. So in here it says, now therefore command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will give you wages for your servants according to all that you say, for you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidians. I think they said that right. The idea being that you have, let's say you have a skilled craftsman, you have, you know, 50 people who know how to pave a road, but you need 500. You know, you need, not that there's necessarily a foreman, but you need somebody to work side by side to tell them what they're doing, to work with them. You need a large labor force, but you need your experts there to do the cutting. That's the way, that's my understanding of the way this read is he's sending those men there, 10,000 at a time, to help cut these trees down, because you have a completely separate group mentioned for transport of the trees. Make sense? I'll look into that a little bit more. Or if y'all find something else, let me know. And he said he drafted them from all Israel. That was in 1 Kings 5:13.
So it was the hearing of the stones that he got.
I think so, yes, ma'am. Okay. So how many men does Solomon have hewing stones? 80,000 men hewing stones. How were the trees to be moved from, I put Tyre, from Lebanon to Jerusalem? Okay, so they were put on rafts. So, can you start and ending points, or do you have those? Okay, this they're going to Joppa. So you said by sea. Okay. To take them from Joppa to Jerusalem. All right. So 2 Chronicles 2:16, they go from Lebanon to Joppa by raft. To where it was indicated in that area, and then from Joppa to Jerusalem, best indications are that they were carrying them. It says they're transporting them. It says they're transporting them from there. How many of the? How was the stones to be moved? How were the stones to be moved? Same thing by the transporters. We'll get a little more into that as we talk about building the temple. But one of the other things I wanted to show. Oh, did I turn that off?
No.
Which for what? Second Chronicles 2:18. He appointed 70,000 of them to carry loads and 80,000 to quarry stones in the mountains and 3,600 supervisors. I took it from the two different contexts, from Kings and from Chronicles, that you had 70,000 transporters who were to transport both stones and timber, based on the way it reads in both contexts. The point of all this being is this is a massive undertaking. You think about what they're doing. You think about the size of the cedar trees up there. Okay, you think about the size of the cedar trees. I'm still, the temple really kind of boggles my mind as you read some of this stuff, as you kind of work through it. If they did cut everything to measure. Instead of just piecemealing planks together, they cut everything to fit. You're talking about you needed 30-foot planks to plank the inside of the temple. So you may be carrying 30-foot trees, you know, rafting them down. We'll look at that in a second. And then you may be carrying them or transporting them one way or another, you know, from Joppa down to Jerusalem. So let me get this up here. All right, so I'll just leave it like this. I think maybe everybody can see that. So you're talking about Lebanon is right here. So this is Lebanon. So I'm not sure where they're getting it from. Here's Tyre. This is a present-day map, so it reads a little different. There we go. Hey, look at there. Two fingers works. All right, so that looks a little better. So this is Tyre. So they're gonna somewhere from Lebanon, they're going to float them down from here to... This is Tel Aviv. What used to be called Joppa is now called Jaffa in today's time, and it's right around there. That is 77 to 80 miles, nautical miles, coming down that you're going to raft all these trees. Then you're going to take these trees, and you've got to transport them to Jerusalem across land. How they did that, I don't know. Carrying seems like it would be the most logistical way to do it, seeing as what you don't see in this map is the terrain change. You know, you're going up into the mountains as you're moving these logs. That's, you know, 27 to 30 miles nautically or as the crow flies. You don't know what roads they had paved and how which way they were going to go. So you think about moving all these trees, the time it was going to take and the manpower that it was going to take. This is a huge undertaking. I'm not exactly sure where they were hewing the stones, but the stones being as big as they were too. Think about how they were going to transport them. Most of the times in my research, they didn't use carts. The metal and the way they worked with metal then wasn't going to support the weight of a stone. They drug them on sleds. And so this was a huge undertaking. And from the standpoint of what Solomon has bartered, you know, this is a lot. It's why he needed that many men and why he rotated them out and why he needed so many transporters. Yes, sir. The Great Pyramid was 481 foot tall. Temple was, I think the highest point was 35 foot. You think about, so there, it's not uncommon for them to have it. It's amazing to us now. I don't know if we're just lazier or we're more mechanically minded versus just brute force, but they were able to do this and take care of it. This was a big undertaking. All right, my time is up. Mill's been patient with me. Thank you. Next Sunday, we will go over the temple. And again, I will attempt to use the overhead as we discuss the temple because I think that'd make it the easiest. So, thank you.